Hi. Thank you for joining us. You're listening to Smart Talk, and Al Bergeson and I are here every Saturday, just not together. We take turns. We come every other time. And on this part of the show, we talk about education, what's happening in our schools, what's happening in the legislature and the federal government and the Ed Policy Center, and also how legislation impacts what happens with our students. So if you have a comment or question, give us a call at 520-790-2040. And for the past few days, the education news and headlines in Arizona has been about how Arizona still has 1 out of 5 classrooms staffed by a substitute teacher or a teacher who isn't certified. And one reason they give is the lack of pay. Despite the promised 20% raise in 2020, some districts were not given enough money to fulfill this. And once again, they are taking money from other resources because the state has not kept up its promise. A few days ago, an Arizona Teacher of the Year wrote an op-ed for the local newspaper, and she talked about how she still works 3 jobs to keep her head above water. So we're going to talk about this later in the show, but I mean, this is not right. So our guest today, I'm very happy to say, is Dr. Kevin Henry. He is a native of New Orleans. He graduated from Tulane University and then got his doctorate at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Dr. Henry is an assistant professor of education policy studies and practice and a fellow of the Education Policy Center at the University of Arizona College of Education. He is also one of the foremost scholars on the privatization of New Orleans public schools, which became privatized after Hurricane Katrina. His research and teaching also focus on the impact of privatization, charter schools, and school choice policy. So thanks for coming in on this Saturday.
Thank you for having me.
To start, I'd like to ask you about your research on New Orleans schools. And one thing people don't know is that it's all private. Yes. It's not, there aren't public schools in New Orleans anymore.
Absolutely.
So, could you talk a little bit about that and how it's working for, we'll start with that.
Yes, sure, absolutely. So again, thank you for having me this morning, Robin. I'm so excited to be here.
Thank you.
yes. I think one of the things that folks have to remember, to your point, is that New Orleans is now 100% charter as a district. So this is the first district in the United States to have 100% charters. And so I often think about my work in a few ways. When I was a kid, and I may have told you this story, I don't know for sure. When I was a child, we used to have this commercial. It was a two-row hospital commercial. And the commercial was about, where do babies come from? And so you would have these little kids running around saying, where do babies come from? And then they'll say, oh, babies come from the stork. Or babies come from, you know, grandmother's kitchen. Or babies come from this and this mm-hmm. and that place. And then at the end of the commercial, of course, they'll say, babies come from Touro Hospital, right? So it's really this kind of, you know, tongue-in-cheek thing about what happens in terms of the production of children, right? And the creation of children and how children are delivered. And in some ways, that's what my work is focused on. Not the creation of children and not necessarily where children are produced, but thinking about how charter schools actually come into being in New Orleans. And so I'm focused on where do charters come from? And in some ways, we can think about how charters are birthed and who midwives charters, right? And so I study this thing called the charter school authorization process. And the way I like to think about the authorization process is that it's the central gatekeeping mechanism that's used to determine whether or not a charter school is approved, who gets to open and operate a charter school, and essentially the curriculum, the personnel, the budgets, and the most central aspect is the relationship to the families and the communities in which these charter schools are situated. And so I actually focus on the racial politics of charters and privatization in post-Katrina New Orleans. And so, yes, I'm interested in like things such as student achievement, but I'm more interested in how power is operating in the city and how particular ideas around choice, around democracy, around what constitutes a quality education, those are the things that I'm more interested in. And how privatization in some ways hollows out the promises of democracy and in many ways empties the vestiges of, say, for instance, Brown versus Board of Education and some of the promises that we've said that we want as it relates to educational equity, like quality funding, great teachers, a robust curriculum and teaching practices, and also discipline practices. So in many ways, my work is looking at how charter schools are coming into being and then what happens once they are actually here.
And New Orleans is the perfect example of where it would go if we continue with the policies we have now.
Yes.
One of the things that I've heard about from friends who live in New Orleans is kids with learning disabilities. One friend told me that when her son was in high school, he has a learning disability, and whereas in most schools he would be getting help, in a public school he would be assigned to someone, but that wasn't happening for him in New Orleans, and he got pushed out of one school and then into another and then got pushed out and pushed out and pushed out. By the time he was 19, he had the credits of a freshman mm-hmm. in high school. And so have you seen that in other places? I mean, in other schools and other people in New Orleans where they're not paying attention to all the students?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think one of the challenges of choice, right, is that, or I would say the idea of choice is that schools can be innovative, right? That schools can engage in teaching that's supposed to spur learning, that's supposed to do it for less, and that's supposed to rival that of traditional public schools. The challenge in New Orleans and other cities or other markets that have choice in charters is that oftentimes, because the focus is almost singularly on student achievement, right, and narrowly measured by test scores, we see that schools are pushing out and keeping students that are differently abled or that might be English language learners, in the case of New Orleans increasingly, from those spaces, right? Because theoretically, those students are, quote unquote, harder to teach, harder to work with. Mm-hmm. And so it's fascinating. I have a colleague who is a psychologist, and she, to your point, asked me one day, she said, Kevin, I'm just curious because I have a client who has a student who has special needs, who's a child who has special needs, and the school said, we don't offer these services. You need to look elsewhere. And she said, is that legal? Mm-hmm. And I said, no. The idea, Individuals with Disability and Education Act is not gone because we have charters, right? Schools are required by law, federal law, to educate all students that enter into those spaces. But what we see happening across the board, as well as in Arizona, we can think about BASES as a model of this, or an example of this, is that students that are differently abled are pushed away and pushed out. And so that example that you gave of your friend's son, this is not irregular. In fact, unfortunately, it's the norm. And we see this happening across New Orleans, and we see this happening across many districts that have decided to overwhelmingly embrace charters. We can see this in Chicago. We can see this in D.C. We can see this in New York, Detroit, so on and thus forth. So that, to me, is probably one of the most damning aspects, because it's in many ways, an intentional design to exclude certain populations from that space. And it ultimately betrays the contract that we were told, which was that we will educate all students and we will do it for less and we'll do it better than public schools. And when we look at the data, we don't see that happening. And in fact, about 1 in 4 charter schools outperform traditional public schools. So when we think about this notion of like 1 in 4 charter schools outperforming, that's not very many. And so I drive a Nissan Altima, which may not be anybody's business, but nevertheless, this is what I drive. And if I went to the Nissan dealership and they told me only 1 in 4 Altimas outperform, say, Toyota Camrys, I would have to really rethink the idea of whether or not this is the car that I want to purchase, right? And so what we realize is that when we look at the data with most charter schools, they're not actually doing any better. We see that students are being suspended and expelled at higher rates. We see that there's increased segregation. We see that students that are English language learners or students with disabilities are not included in these spaces. So then we must ask, well, why are we actually doing this, right? And that is a different question than we usually ask about education. We don't ask the why. We ask, what do we need to do? And the why behind charters is actually the more insidious part, which is to suggest or say that these schools are actually not about educating. Many of them are not about educating children that perhaps have been most vulnerable and that have been situated structurally and literally in these kind of oppressive states. But rather, it's about money, and it's about power, and it's about restructuring the notion of democracy and restructuring how we understand each other in the world, right? This is, I'm kind of going on a tangent, but I don't know if you remember, most of us remember September 11th. It just happened, not the anniversary, it was a few weeks ago. And one of the most interesting things that happened was that George Bush went out and told us to buy things, not to be citizens, but to be consumers. And I think that's when we think about charters, that's what happens. It's like, let's be consumers, actually not citizens in a democracy. And that's really the scary part that we're in.
We're going to take a break right now. We're here with Professor Kevin Henry. And I have a question when you get back about a paper you wrote called Locking the Door Before We Had Keys.
Okay.
Hi, we're back. You're listening to Smart Talk. I'm your host, Robin Hiller, and I'm speaking with Dr. Kevin Henry from the University of Arizona College of Education. And he is one of the foremost authorities on not only on the charterization of New Orleans, but on charter schools and their impact all over the country. So you had a paper that I believe was about New Orleans, and it was called Locking the Door Before We Had the Keys. Mm-hmm. So how did that charter authorization impact who opened the charters?
Yeah, absolutely. So that paper, I actually was interested in something else, right? And what I mean by that is when I started investigating charter schools or studying charter schools, I was interested in this idea, or wanted to test the idea. I wanted to see if there was an existence proof, so to speak, of the successful charter schools that were operated by Black people, right? And I kept looking and looking and looking, and I saw so few of them. Mm-hmm. Not in the sense that there were none that existed and they just didn't were unable to produce the results, but there were just very few charter schools that were operated by Black people writ large. So I said, well, that's kind of interesting, right? Mm-hmm. So then I said, well, what better place to look than a place that's moving towards all charter schools? You would imagine that there would be diversity in the market. That there's not only going to be McDonald's around, that you're going to see a Burger King and some other place, I don't know, Five Guys and Carl's Jr. around. This is not to support
anything. I want to put in a plug for Five Guys.
Five Guys. I'm going to say this is not to support anything. But now that you've said it, Robin, I do like Five Guys. It's my preference. But I was interested in thinking about and investigating what was happening to folks that were in New Orleans that wanted to open up charter schools. And so I looked at two populations, essentially, in various levels, right? And so I looked at essentially a racial analysis, so African-Americans and white folks who were opening up charter schools. But I also was interested in the kind of ideological practices that these charter schools were espousing. Were they saying things, for instance, that we want to open up schools that are community oriented, that are focused on, you know, multicultural teaching and culturally relevant teaching? Mm-hmm. Were we thinking about schools that wanted to, in many ways, curtail the discipline disparities? Like, that's a different school versus the school that says we are in a no excuse school, right? And we want to focus on results only. And so what I began to find was that many of the African Americans that wanted to open up schools in post-Katrina New Orleans were veteran teachers, so people that were, you know, traditionally educated. They were part of the teachers union that before it was dismembered and disbanded in many ways. These folks were part of community organizations, and they were essentially African Americans who were trying to remake and refashion the city post-Katrina, right? So we think about who has the right to the city. And these people wanted to put, in many ways, their footprint in the sand, so to speak, mm-hmm. of post-Katrina New Orleans. And then we also saw this kind of alternate group, which were people that were coming from all out of state, many of whom were affiliated with Teach for America and other alternative certification programs like Teach NOLA or the New Teacher Project. And they were opening up schools, right? And so what I wanted to see was, well, what is the philosophy? What's the practice? What's happening between these two schools? And so in one instance, there was one year I looked, and 90% of the African-American applicants, what I call espoused a communitarian approach to education. So they wanted to focus on all those things that the research tells us is really rich and powerful in changing children's lives for the better. They were denied. Those that were approved were those that wanted to align most with market ideology, that wanted to align most with privatization and the notion of accountability as only understood through test scores, right? They weren't interested in teachers. They weren't interested in teacher pay in the traditional sense. They weren't interested in having teachers that were unionized. They weren't interested in parents as a kind of a central galvanizing force for education, but rather telling parents, this is what you have mm-hmm. to do. So it's in very many ways, it's very paternalistic. And they were overwhelmingly approved. So the paper that I wrote, which was about locking the doors, it was a phrase from one of my participants. And she was essentially getting at the idea that post-Katrina New Orleans, Black people were trying to get back into the city. They were trying to create institutions. They were trying to rebuild what they understood to be home. But the door was already locked. They didn't even have the key to the place that they understood as their home space. And as such, they were not able, for instance, in this case, to open up schools. And this was seen across various institutions, public housing, jobs and workforce, healthcare, all of those spaces that make a city and a community, Black people were locked out of that. And so Black people were also locked out, consequently, of being able to open up charter schools under visions of their choosing that connected with their communities, that engaged in the types of practices that we know in education make profound impacts on children and their learning. And so that paper is really kind of getting at the challenges that existed as it relates to the charter school authorization process. And what I essentially was getting at or articulating was that the charter school authorization process is both raced and classed in very particular ways. And not only that, it was the exclusion of African Americans from the process, but also there was a particularly limited notion of what schooling might look like for Black children in the city that care for God, which is the term that we use to talk about New Orleans. And so it was very clear from the participants in my study that they felt that they were excluded and that they were silenced and muted in this larger process of the reshaping and revisioning of New Orleans.
You know, it's interesting that you bring that up because, so this is the example of New Orleans, mm-hmm. but it's very similar in Arizona. So there's a charterization, there's a way people can apply to get help starting their charter.
Yeah.
And so a group of teachers, three of whom are, one was math teacher of the year, one is science teacher of the year and national, and a group of teachers who were coming from public schools thought, we're going to open a charter. Mm-hmm. So they spent a year developing this, what this school would look like. And all of them are committed to public schools, but they started getting really excited, like mm-hmm. this would be the dream for students. Mm-hmm. And so they applied, and the grant was for 3 years. They did not make the cut. Mm-hmm. There was not a single person who made the cut. The committee is made up half former Teach for America mm-hmm. and half charter school operators. Mm-hmm. There was not one school applicant, prospective school applicant that got it that had ever taught in the public schools.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's a different mindset.
Yeah. Well, it's first off ideological, right? It's about who gets to control schools and what vision of schooling might we want to offer up, right? But it's also deeply, so one of the findings of the study was that the social network that one was a part of was essential, right, in terms of thinking about who was being approved and who was being denied. So if you were coming from this veteran teaching force, if you were coming from New Orleans, you were seen as not necessary for the redevelopment. And in the case of this that you spoke of in Arizona, it makes sense, right? That those networks that are, you know, often funded by the Gates Foundation or the Broad Foundation or the Walton Foundation, there's a type of ideological work that's being made manifest in those spaces. And those networks are super powerful, right? When we think about Teach for America and now Teach for All that has gone global, right? Those spaces are trying to cultivate a particular vision of schooling that is not actually about traditional democratic principles, but mostly about controlling children and their comportment and creating parents to be these kind of singular placeholders. But what I think is also important is that it's actually creating a monopoly, right? And so when we think about markets and education, like any type of market, right? We can think of, for instance, Apple might have a monopoly on cell phones. Everyone wants an Apple phone. There's just a new Apple phone that just came out, right? And almost everyone has it. And so there's often no diversity or limited diversity within education markets, but also it's about controlling the market. So if you have a monopoly, that means that people that have differing visions, right, are not a part of that. And it's actually about maintaining your power, your position, and your privilege within that market. And what's also important is that when we think about the inception of markets, monopolies become really, really important because it's not only to say this person doesn't need to be here. We don't want them to actually truly to compete with us. But it's also to stabilize the market in a very particular way so that the future of the market looks as it began. And so it's not really about the notion of competition. It's more so about creating stability in the market along an ideological and political project. And so it makes total sense that even in Arizona, right, veteran teachers are also pushed out because there's a particular way of thinking and socializing that may come about from being traditionally educated or to be connected to social justice and equity initiatives.
So what you're saying basically is, especially in New Orleans, they were playing the long game.
The long game.
Yes.
It's let me make this market about what I want it to be.
And then I see there's two. You mentioned ideologues, people who really believe this is a system that publicly run schools, you know, can never do the job because they're publicly run.
Yeah.
And that's where we get the derogatory term government schools.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But I always like to point out that when Arizona became a state, we could not join until we agreed to publicly fund education, or as they called it at that time, the common schools.
Mm-hmm.
But then there's another group, I think, and that are those are the motivated by money, want to make a buck.
Mm-hmm.
For example, Primavera, which is a charter school in Arizona, it's online, has the third highest dropout rate in the state. Last fall, a year ago, it was released that the owner paid himself $10 million for the running of that school. And 2 weeks later, went before the charter board and was awarded another charter to open another school.
Mm-hmm.
There's legislators like that too, I know. But it's just so shocking.
Yeah. Well, I don't think we should be shocked, right? I mean, it is shocking. It should be both shocking and angering, right? In the words of Maya Angelou, if you're not angry, then you must be a rock. We should be crying out in some ways about what is actually taking place in schools across the nation, and most specifically, how this is impacting some of the most vulnerable populations who are hopeful about charter schools and even voucher programs to provide their children with the education that is actually worthy of their children. But that's not actually happening. To your point about Primavera, and how they're doing scholastically. And so I'm of the mind that these are not actually about success, but it's rather about a political project.
Yes. The other thing is that it's weird that they're doing so poorly and being rewarded, because under Ducey's plan, where he rewards schools that are doing well, that's the whole thing. He thinks that the more money you give, the better the teachers will do. It's like they're in their teaching and they're just waiting for the extra $55 so they can really bring out the good stuff. We're going to go for a small break and we will be right back. This is Robin Hiller and I am speaking with Professor Kevin Henry. Hi, we're back. You're listening to Smart Talk. I am sitting here with Professor Kevin Henry, who is a professor and researcher at the University of Arizona in the College of Education. One of the things that I wanted to talk about is the inequity, the unfairness of our discipline thing. A lot of schools, and it was just in the newspaper the other day, Mesa Unified had gotten some threats, and so they started using this phrase, zero tolerance. Can you talk a little bit about what zero tolerance is and the impact?
Yeah, so I mean, it is what it sounds like, right? Which is that the school will not tolerate misbehavior, period, right? Or what they construe and construct as misbehavior. And as such, what we see as it relates to zero tolerance is the increase of suspension and expulsion and ever punitive approaches to education. And so generally, when we think about zero tolerance, it's something that has come about, in fact, from the 80s, right? It's a vestige in some ways of the Reagan administration, as well as the Bush administrations, and thinking about how we want to be tough, you know, on crime and have wars on drugs, right? And so that kind of ideology and that perspective translates also into schools. So we're not going to accept misbehavior. We're not going to accept students doing things that are seen as outside of the norms of the school. And if they do, we're going to suspend them, which actually seems kind of counterintuitive, because you actually want to keep children in schools, not kick them out of schools so they can actually learn.
And zero tolerance. I just want to give an example of a call I received when I was working for Voices for Education. A gentleman called. He lived up in Oro Valley. Mm-hmm. And he said, my son, who's in third grade, has been expelled not only for the school year, but for any school in our district.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And he wanted to know if there was a charter available. Anyway, this was the crime of his third grade old. Let's say he's eight. So his father had given him a pocket knife.
Mm-hmm.
He trades the pocket knife with his neighbor,
mm-hmm.
who's also in third grade. The neighbor goes to school. The neighbor gets in a fight, and they find the pocket knife. The kid never took it out of his pocket. Those two kids were kicked out of school for the entire school year from the entire district.
Yeah.
And you just think, that doesn't seem like the right path.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, one of the questions is the response developmentally appropriate? That's just one thing. Mm-hmm. These are third graders, right? Is this the way that we want to move forward in thinking about change? Is this the way we want to think about how we educate children and how we might actually think about restructuring our schools to be places that are safe, not spaces that allow for violence, right? But spaces that help people to grow into being better human beings, right? And so I think there's this question that we have to, in some ways, balance between retribution and restoration. And some of my work is focused on this notion of restorative justice, which I think we can talk about in a little. But I think this idea of restoration exceeds the retribution approach. And the retribution approach is going to ask something very simple, which is, what law or rule was broken? And who broke it? And what punishment is available, or rather, what punishment is deserved for that? And that's a very narrow, punitive way of thinking about change and thinking about discipline. And I think the restorative approach asks a different question, which is, what is the harm that was done versus what rule was broken? So how was someone actually hurt or harmed in this process? And then what are the needs and obligations of all of those that have been affected by said harm? And then the other question is, how can all of those affected parties come in place to heal the harm that has been enacted? And that's different from saying, here's the rule that you broke, and now this is your punishment, right? And I think we have to reorient ourselves to think about punishment and discipline very differently, right? And so one of the things that I think about is that we in schools are very much heavy on the punishment aspect and less interested in discipline. So discipline for me is really simple, which is that it's a way to train oneself, right? It's a way to commit oneself to something. We can think about discipline of an athlete, right? You may need to get up at 5 a.m. I was on the swim team for about 2 weeks because I had to get up at 5 a.m., and I wasn't that disciplined in high school, right? But it's a way to mentally and physically arrange oneself into becoming a type of person or entity that you want to be, right? So how do I structure my life in a way that achieves a larger goal? That's discipline. Punishment actually is not interested in changing behavior. It's more so interested in making you feel bad about something that you've done, right? It's usually top down, right? So someone is punishing you, which has nothing to do with your internal behavior, but rather someone saying, you did this wrong, so I'm going to do this to you. And it's about control, and it's usually ineffective. And so what we do in schools is we're more interested in punishing children than helping children develop actual discipline practices that help them to achieve and become the individuals that they want to be.
So African-American kids are four times more likely to be suspended than white kids. And this is even true in preschool.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so we're talking 3 to 4 year olds. And according to the U.S. Department of Education, while African-American preschoolers make up less than 20% of kids in preschool, they're responsible for close to 50% of the suspensions. What kind of activity would result in a suspension of a 3 or 4 year old?
That baffles me because I have no idea what type of activity that would be, right? When we think about a 3 or 4 year old, what actually could they do?
I know. First, you're bigger than that. Yes. We have a caller.
Yes.
Hi, Gary.
Hi, I'm glad that y'all are talking about this. The no tolerance is one extreme, and I've been keeping up with what's been happening in California, where they just recently passed that from K to 12. They will not discipline the children whatsoever. They will not take the person out of school. And so it's a free reign of the kids. And so with both sides, you see the examples of how it went down the slippery slope. Are you aware of the legislation that just went on in California?
So I think the California legislation, I'm less aware of the fact that they won't, that suspension and expulsions are less seen as the viable option, and more so aware that California, excuse me, particularly if we think about the schools in the Bay Area, for instance, San Francisco Unified School District is a really great example, is that they have been more interested in how do we keep students in schools and what ways might we address discipline without kicking students out of schools, right? And so one of the things that San Francisco has implemented is the restorative justice approach, which includes things like this notion of a circle where students are sitting around with each other and thinking about and discussing the harm. There's this notion of restorative conferencing that's been used in the criminal justice system for years, where folks are less interested in, again, that punitive, like, I'm going to kick someone out, versus how do we fix the problem that's at hand? And that's a different orientation. And I think California is trying in some ways to move towards that orientation, which is about addressing trauma, which is about addressing behaviors, which is also about addressing the clear disparities that exist as it relates to suspension and expulsion. So you mentioned in preschool almost about how 50% of Black kids that are in preschool, and be mindful that Black people only represent about 16% of the population. So this is a huge disparity racially, but also thinking about students that are ELL students and students that are special needs students. If we look at Arizona, for instance, and I thought this was fascinating, and by fascinating, horrifying, right? That students with disabilities in elementary schools and middle schools are twice as likely as students without disabilities to receive suspensions in Arizona, right? And we see this in the case of Native populations in our state, as well as Black and Latino populations. Black children are 8 times more likely in charter schools, for instance, in Arizona, to receive suspension. And Latino students are 6 times more likely to receive suspensions. And so I think the California case could perhaps be a model for us in thinking about how do we systematically reorganize our schools, not towards not accounting and holding people accountable for the acts that they engage in, but how do we make sure that students are in some ways addressing the trauma that it's caused and addressing the harm that it's caused. And so one of the things that's really important about restorative justice and restorative approaches to education is that it's not anything goes, right? You don't get to say that, well, I hurt someone, and so here we go, we're going to sit in a circle and talk about it. Actually, the harm that has been caused actually has to be addressed. And the person that may be, quote unquote, the victim has to create and think about a remedy that makes sense for them, which may very well include suspension, right? So it's not that you're not holding children accountable for their behavior. It's rather, how do we think about accountability differently as opposed to just saying we're going to kick this child out? Because what we know, the data is very, very clear. If you suspend a child, right, there are some myths that I think actually exist. One myth is that if you suspend a child, somehow they're going to come back rehabilitated and the best child in the classroom. And that's not true, right? If you suspend a child, more than likely they will be suspended again, right? And we know that those suspensions also are not objective, but also very much racialized. And I think the other thing is that if we think about student achievement, right, that if we get the kids out and they come back and we, you know, bring them back into the classroom, that they're going to become these super achievers. And so that's not actually necessarily true. So we see that children that are suspended and expelled.
It's so weird people have that idea, yeah. Because we know that if students miss a certain amount of school, like if they're sick,
yes,
They're behind.
And so what we know is that children that are suspended and expelled are more likely to be connected to prison, right, and what people call the school to prison pipeline, then actually graduate, right?
Do you have an example of restorative justice that you could give?
Yeah, so here's a really interesting example. There was a student, he was a high school student, right? And this was not within school, but this is outside of schools. But I can give an in-school example as well. But outside of school, this student stole someone's car, right? This is a pretty big crime.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was an approach that we can send him to jail, essentially, and he has to pay back the fines, or he has to pay particular fines, and he has to return the car and so on and thus forth, right? And the woman whose car was stolen said, what other alternatives might exist for this 16-year-old? And so they said, well, you know, we could try this restorative justice approach. And so she said, okay, let's try that. And so the car was actually damaged. I believe he got into an accident. And so the damage was totaling, let's say, like $8,000. Now, this child doesn't have $8,000, and nor did his family have $8,000 to pay. So she said, well, what can we do? And essentially what they decided to do, because he was an artist, was that he created art in this woman's house for a year, right? And they worked together to create an arts organization in, I believe it was California, right, for other students who might be placed at risk, quote unquote, right? And that is a different, totally different approach than sending this child to jail and he and his family having to pay $8,000. And the woman was totally excited about the opportunity to mentor and work with this young person because she saw his highest potential. She did not see him solely as a criminal, which is also part of what happens with discipline disparities, which is that we see these children, and this is the proverbial we because I don't, but folks see these children as criminals, as people who are have the potentiality to become criminals, and not as human beings who have the right to make mistakes, but also have the right to grow and to learn, and who are offered and deserve a little grace. And so that's a different way of orienting ourselves. And we see that, we know, for instance, the racial disparities are clear. White children may engage in very similar behaviors, but they are not suspended. They are not expelled. In fact, they're given second and multiple chances over and over and over again. So I think that's one example of how do we do this differently. And I think you had a question.
Oh, but, in one article I read, there was a boy who was being expelled, African-American high schooler, and he said he'd gotten in a fight with this white guy, and he said the white guy said, well, you don't know what the circumstances are, and so proceeded to do. And the principal actually said to that young man, you're going to go far.
Mm.
When the African-American student brought that up, they said, we don't like your attitude.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, you are challenging our authority.
Yes.
And it was very different. I actually know of a restorative justice thing that has this kind of amazing end. Anyway, these kids broke into a house and they had a fight with fire extinguishers.
Okay.
And so the house was covered in that white foam when the people came back. And they broke paintings. They knocked things off the wall. And so the owner of the house did not want to call the police.
Mm-hmm.
And he knew who the kids were because the kids went to the same school as his kid and had posted photographs of it on their phone that they were sending around to all their buddies.
Mm-hmm.
So he said, you know, here's what you need to do. They had a meeting with both families and they came in and they said to the kid, the instigator, you have to tell you what, we will not call the cops, but you have to get in 40 hours of volunteerism.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And at first he said, I want to volunteer at this shelter for kids.
Mm-hmm.
And the victim said, I don't think that's a good idea.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
'Cause the guy was always also had some other things that were going on. And so he ends up volunteering at Habitat for Humanity.
Mm-hmm.
And that year is awarded, this is a kid who's been trouble,
mm-hmm.
was awarded Volunteer of the Year by Habitat for Humanity.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And felt like this was such a worthy project to be working on.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think, what does it mean for us to consider that not only people can change, but there might be things that we can do to help people change without contributing to suffering?
Mm-hmm.
And far too often, we're more interested in the contributions to suffering because I want to get you back than to the actual change that we really want to see. And so many of the things that happen in restorative justice approaches is exactly that, that people have the opportunity to change and to grow and to see other people's humanity. And that is a different educational project. That's part of the reason why we don't see this happening across schools, because we as a culture are less interested, although we're very much interested in redemption as a kind of American ethos, right? But we're not actually interested in the redemption and the ability for populations of color, particularly Black and Latino and Native populations, to have access to that, right? So the mythology of the United States is about we offer ultimate choices and opportunities, and we believe that people can change. We don't say that this is a Christian nation, but literally there were Protestants that came here and formed a nation around these very specific religious ideals, partially about redemption and grace and second chances. And we don't offer that to Black and brown children specifically. And we're sort of a justice tries to reorient us to thinking about how might we do that.
We will be right back. We're talking with Professor Kevin Henry, and we've been talking about restorative justice. And I actually have a few more questions about it, so we'll talk about that when we get back.
Okay.
Thanks. Hi, we're back. You're listening to Smart Talk on KVOI. We're here every Saturday morning, and I am speaking with Dr. Kevin Henry. And one of the things I wanted to ask you about is the idea of counselors versus police officers on campus. And I just heard something from the sheriff up in Pima County, I mean in Maricopa County, was talking about how counselors need to be the first response. Mm-hmm. And then he's not opposed to cops on campus. I know there are a lot of people are and just say, we got to get the counselors on. We have the highest counselor student ratio in the country. But what are your thoughts about that?
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm of the mind that we probably should not have cops on campus. Mm-hmm. People with guns. This in and of itself creates a space where students are feeling unsafe and unsupported generally, right? And that even gets more escalated when we think about Black and brown children on campuses. So we can think of, I don't know if you all remember, there was an incident in Columbia, South Carolina at Spring Valley High School. And the cop literally flipped this, I don't know, 12-year-old, 13-year-old child, right, out of her desk and dragged her.
Yes.
Right? Do you remember that?
Yes. There's a video of it.
It's on YouTube. You can see it everywhere. It's in some ways kind of pornographic in the sense that it's disastrous and we're looking at it, but it titillates people in some weird way. But the idea of the cop is to instill a level of fear and discipline in children, or in fear and punishment, excuse me, in children, that is actually not productive in terms of their educational well-being or their mental and emotional well-being. And so far too often, we see disparities in the current incarceration and prison system. So what would make us think that having cops on campus would somehow curtail that, right? We know that the prison industrial complex impacts Black and brown people and increasingly impacts Black women, right, in very negative and harmful ways. So how do we then think creating and placing the same people that do this in the larger society in an even more small and vulnerable space is going to somehow remedy the issues that we're interested in remedying? And I don't know if we're actually interested in dealing with and tackling the so-called discipline disparities that exist, or if we're interested in making sure that children are behaving well. Because if we were interested in that, that's when you actually do bring counselors and social workers on campus. That's when you actually do have a school that is created and organized around the whole child, right? And so when we think about the use of counselors, right, on campus, most schools are woefully underfunded, most mm-hmm. traditional public schools, as well as charters, right, in the sense of having counselors. Some of them don't even have counselors or social workers, right? So when we think about people who have been trained to be mental health professionals, right, and advocates, and getting down to issues of trauma and harm and hurt, that's what they're supposed to do, not only figure out the child's schedule, which is where mm-hmm. we now use, because Arizona has such a terrible student to counselor ratio that people are doing, in many ways, the terrible, the important, but limited work of only focusing on, let's get this child scheduled together, as opposed to, let's address some of the systemic issues that are taking place in our schools. And so we need more counselors, not fewer. We need more counselors, not more cops, right, in our schools, because not only is it an ethical issue, and a moral issue. But this is actually an organizational issue. If we want to create the schools that we say we want, then we have to think about not creating these so-called safe spaces that are riddled with harm, but rather spaces that open up opportunities for children to learn and grow and feel as if they can be the best persons that they can be. And counselors are key to that, not police.
Right. Counselors and social workers, yeah. We should have them on campus. Are there districts? You said California was moving when Gary called. He was talking about California, and you said they are moving towards restorative justice on a statewide. Are there any states that have done that, or do you know of districts that have done that? Or
yeah, fewer states. Mm-hmm. More. This unfortunately is in some ways a limited approach because we are so wedded to the idea that we have to suspend children, that we have to be the most punitive, right? That we have to be tough on misbehavior, quote unquote, right? And most of that misbehavior is subjective, right? So when we think about the students that are differently abled and have disabilities, or students that are in kindergarten and preschool, right? Those things are quite subjective, right? And for instance, if we go back to South Carolina, they have a disturbing school statute. And part of that statute, some of the language is used that says to act in an obnoxious way. So what does that actually mean, right? And we see this panning out very differently across racial lines. But in terms of districts that are increasingly trying to use restorative approaches, we do see particular schools. For instance, even in TUSD, right, at Tucson Unified School District, they are attempting to engage in restorative approaches in our home state, right? We see this happening in some schools in New York, right? We see this happening in some schools in New Orleans, but often, far too often, it's not a district level approach, and it's not a statewide policy.
And has it been going on long enough that you can see results, or is it still too new?
Well, it is still very new, mainly because...
Or if it has happened results.
It mainly because folks aren't approaching it as an approach, right? We see very limited approaches nationwide, but we see that students in schools that are engaging in restorative justice are seeing fewer suspensions, better culture and climate in their schools, and increase in learning, right? And so, for instance, there's a wonderful book by the scholar Maisha Nguyen. She's at UC Davis, and Maisha's book is Justice on Both Sides. And the book begins to talk about a district in the Midwest that engages in restorative justice and how students are taking the mantle for themselves to create the schools that they want. And so that's what we want in schools, where children feel that they have agency and that they're valued and that they're committed. The central concern of discipline in schools is not misbehavior of the child, but rather that children don't feel as if this school is a space where they can be. And more precisely, we often see discipline issues in schools or with children where teachers aren't doing the things that they might be needing to do, right? So part of what we need to have a conversation about is thinking about how do we engage in pedagogical practices that keep students in class, that keep students engaged, and keep students and make students feel as if they belong in these spaces.
Can you define pedagogical?
Yes, teaching practice. Just a big fancy word that we use at the university to talk about teaching, right? What are teachers doing? How are they relating to their children in the class, and how are they engaging with the pedagogy and the curriculum that is being offered? Like, how do you teach that?
So, would one way to get restorative justice in is to start with the teachers, like when they are students and when they are becoming teachers, mm-hmm. is have restorative justice as part of the bag of tricks they
yes,
have,
yes.
So that when they go into schools. And also that they're aware of some of the numbers of mm-hmm. what's happening and what mm-hmm. that looks like on a sheet of paper with a graph.
Yeah.
Because I think that if they have that skill, they could start using it on a micro level in their classrooms, which would then filter out.
Ripple out.
And we could have it both up and down.
Yes.
Coming from the top, coming from the bottom.
Yeah.
Not that the teachers are the bottom.
Yes.
But the governor is.
The governor. I think that we need to not only have teachers, right? So teachers... A lot of pre-service educators don't have restorative justice work being done, right? Or being taught about restorative justice. Because it's in some ways, it's a very old concept, but it's very new in our field, right? So we don't have a lot of people working on it and teaching about it and writing about it. excluding, for instance, Maisha Wynn's work. But I think one of the things that this has to be a conjoint effort, right? So it has to be both the teachers, as well as the administration at the school site, but also the district level administration. So one of the occurrences that I've had is that many teachers are gung-ho about trying this new approach,
mm-hmm.
but they don't have the organizational support from administrators, and administrators may not have the support from district level superintendents and APs, right? So that, if we want to do this, we have to be on board, right? Everyone, when we think about accountability and testing, everyone had to fall in line with that, right? Teachers, right. School leaders, the district. But if we want to tackle suspension and expulsion, everyone has to also be on board for that. And we usually don't have the political will to do that, but we have to really move ourselves and have the, we have to have the cojones, right, to do that type of work that's necessary to create schools that are worthy of our children.
Well, I also think just talking about this and getting the word out, it's like some of the things that are happening politically in the country. 10 years ago, they wouldn't have happened. And yeah. Talking about restorative justice and getting people involved and doing research, you are doing wonderful work. Thank you for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
Bye.